from the attorneys. Case set is CV18691, Superior Health Plan, Inc., and William B. Glom, M.D., versus Linda Bedoo.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. Brad Hancock and Jim Galliotto for Superior Health Plan, Inc.
Morning, Mr. Hancock.
William Glom, also Lisa Alvarado on behalf of Dr. Glom.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Casey Lowe and Brad Reeves on behalf of the athlete.
Very well, Mr. Lowe. Thank you all. As you know, each side will have 20 minutes to argue. I take it you've had a chance to get with the clerk and reserve whichever time you want for rebuttal. As you may know, our lighting system here will give you notice when the yellow light comes on. You have 2 minutes remaining in whichever period you're within in your argument. When the red light comes on, you need to finish up any question you may be on, but look to the court for further permission to proceed. Today's proceedings are being audio recorded, and you will be able to download those recordings from the court's website. They should be up by tonight or tomorrow. By way of housekeeping, anyone in the crowd has a cell phone, pager, or other device that might go off, and that would be a good time to turn that off. And with that, we will hear from the attorneys here today. Mr. Hancock.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Brad Hancock, and along with Jim Galliotto and Lisa Alvarado, we are here on behalf of Superior Health Plan, Inc., and Dr. William Brindle Glom. The court is presented with a TCPA issue in the context of managed care dispute. Appellees contend in a novel approach that the TCPA should not be applied to any of their claims asserted in this case for two reasons. Number one, without seriously contesting the application of the TCPA, they contend it's not applicable, but then fall back upon the application of three of the four exemptions under the TCPA. With respect to their burden, they also fail to establish via clear and specific evidence each of the prima facie elements of the eight pled claims.
I mean, isn't it your burden at first, though, to show the TCPA applies? And this seems like it's off the charts as far as going, stretching the TCPA.
Your Honor, it is our burden with respect to preponderance of evidence. And I think with respect to the speech that is alleged in the petition, it squarely falls within the TCPA.
Well, clarify for me, because wasn't the speech just informing them of your decision on the claim?
No, Your Honor. It is not just informing them of the decision of the plan. In fact, looking at the record with respect to the speech itself, they do talk about informing the decision. And that's the initial speech they talk about with respect to the appellees, communications with Ms. Badawo about the minor on the determination with respect to the nursing care. But then it goes beyond that. And there are between 47 and 68 references to speech, but it's principally tied to Superior Health Plan's communication with HHSC, the Department of Health and Human Services, which is an arm of the state. And it's important in the context of the allegations of this case to recall that this is not your typical TCPA case. It's not your typical TCPA case because there's a contract, managed care contract, between my client, Superior Health Plan, Inc., and the state to manage federal Medicaid dollars that are delegated to the state to dole out, not in an insurance context, but to dole out to pay for services for covered individuals.
And so under that logic, every time your client fulfills its duty under that contract and tells HHSC, grant or deny a benefit, that's a communication that's protected and triggers the TCPA.
No, Your Honor. And I would say that it's not, because typically, I think if, for instance, there were a claim for services, we're entitled to a back surgery, and we haven't had that back surgery. Does the claim relate to that speech? Typically, it would not. Here, the plaintiff's pleadings control the application of the TCPA. The application of the TCPA here is focused upon largely the lobbying efforts of Superior. They, in fact, use the word lobbying, which is of public interest and clearly a form of very protected speech. And so they focus upon Superior's contacts with the state HHSC department by saying, number one, they're going around behind closed doors, speaking with them via text, via email, via phone call, meeting apparently with smoke-filled rooms to contend that the care here should not be approved. What they fail to recognize, Your Honor, is they're using the federally mandated program, the state-adopted principles and guidelines, with respect to when to approve care, which is a matter of public concern under Lippincott, as we cite in our papers.
Were they talking about care with regard to any other patient other than the person at interest in this case?
And Your Honor, that's a question that Judge Burgess asked from the state bench as well. They vaguely allude to it, but the claims here are tied specifically to Badawo and the minor at issue. And so the speech that she refers to is trying to convince HHSC to make a determination through these lobbying efforts to essentially deny the 24/7 one-on-one care for the minor.
But didn't HHSC hire them to make those determinations and advise them on those things?
They hire them. Essentially, they contract out the state's obligations to step in and manage Medicare, here Star Health, for foster children.
Just trying to figure out how that's lobbying.
Well, Your Honor, the pleadings themselves reflect that that's what they're contending it is.
Well, if they call it that, that doesn't make it that. I mean, don't we look at the contract and the actual substance rather than words in their pleading? If they call it lobbying, that doesn't change the nature of the communication.
It doesn't change the nature of the communication, but under Hirsch versus Tatum, Texas Supreme Court 2017, the court indicated you don't look at the defendant's pleadings or the defendant's allegations. You look at the pled claims, the words included in plaintiff's petition. They use lobbying. And that's important because they contend that the lobbying is used to essentially divert and change the state's mind through petition to the government, the arm of the government through HHSC, to change its mind to deny care in this instance. And so, yes, it's contracted out, but it's speech related to that contract, not for the benefit of Badawo as a customer or a consumer of goods or services, but with respect to the communication with HHSC. And it's important because what they suggest is that communication with HHSC should be somehow limited. And so what they're suggesting this court should do is chill the speech between my client, Superior Healthcare LLC, and HHSC by either shutting it down or punishing Superior for having the very communication that I think the contract with HHSC requires Superior to have.
If Superior had made these statements in another context, say publicly, would they have even been allowed to do that by law? Or is there some privacy concern that would legally keep them from making such a statement?
They couldn't make statements identifying the minor, just as I cannot identify the minor on this record, Your Honor. And so they could not do that. However, you can in the context, and there's under the managed care arrangement between the state, they can discuss directly with HHSC, but my client cannot go into the public and say, Joe Blow or minor X and provide a name should not receive this type of care. Because there is a overarching privacy under HIPAA that prevents my client from doing so. That does not, nonetheless, prevent my client from speaking about the issues involved, as it did before the Texas legislature, a mere 6 days before this lawsuit was filed. In addressing the specifics, again, before a panel of the Texas legislature, identifying these specific facts related to this specific minor and Ms. Badawo individually. And so certainly the attempt now to file that suit 6 days after would have a chilling impact if this court were not to apply the TCPA and find that the exemptions do not apply.
As far as damages they seek, which of those damages flow from that testimony to the legislature after the bad medical result for the minor?
It's hard to determine.
Wasn't the damage already done?
The damage with respect to the decision had already been made, yes. One of the things they're trying to stop, though, is they're trying to contend, and you'll see it in the pleadings, they're trying to contend, for instance, that my client should not be able to hire HHSC former employees, which Dr. Glom was, because they may be susceptible to lobbying, they may be susceptible to having some influence on HHSC, which goes back to Judge Burgess's question with respect to, is it just this individual? And I think with respect to the TCPA analysis, it's not the damages that the court should focus upon, but instead the speech and whether or not the exemptions apply. With respect to the exemptions that they identify, and I think public concern is addressed in the briefing with respect to Montoya and Lippincott, the exemptions that they principally rely upon are the bodily injury exemption, which there's an amazing dearth of case law, particularly from the circuit addressing bodily injury.
Speaking of that, how do you get around the Kirkstall case?
Yes, Your Honor. Kirkstall is an unusual case because I don't think the TCPA was even, perhaps even vaguely applicable there. Because Kirkstall involved an individual who was involved in the filming of a TV show.
Right.
Who was shot and killed in the context of that filming. In the TCPA, there was no speech involved. That was clearly a bodily injury. Here,
well, the court said we're not going to address that, but we're clearly going to apply the bodily injury exception. So when you have courts applying the bodily injury exception for somebody who is shot after a video is negligently edited, how can you then not apply bodily injury to the facts of your case?
Yes, Your Honor. And it's distinguishable in this manner. Again, you know, in looking at the controlling in Adams versus Starside and Elite Body Works, looking at the construction of the TCPA, you look at the underlying facts. Here, the underlying facts, you look at the claim they asserted out of the gate. It was a Chapter 88 health care liability claim out of the gate, which is not a bodily injury claim.
But do you agree that bodily injury claim isn't defined in the TCPA?
It is defined in the TCPA. However, we have, since there's no case law directly determining, for instance, some of these issues with respect to what bodily injury is in the context of the TCPA, we have to look at other applicable case law. And we cite two cases in our papers, both the Luisiga versus Serta matter out of the Texas Supreme Court 2012, and Alexander versus Colonnades Healthcare, Texas Court of Appeals 14th in Houston 2017. And those cases are instructive on the court's question, because the court looked at where parties are trying to parse healthcare liability claims and transform them or morph them using the same set of operable facts and the same set of pled claims to turn them into something in addition to a healthcare liability claim. And so you have to look at their pleadings here. They plead a Chapter 88 claim. They then try to use, and I would suggest that the court put together side by side the allegations in the amended petition and look at the language. It is a mimeograph from claim to claim to claim. And so attempting to use the same language and splice it from a healthcare liability claim to a bodily injury claim.
So can a healthcare liability claim not be used to recover for bodily injury?
It can, Your Honor. However, this...
I'm really confused on this. You got to help me.
Correct, Your Honor. So it can be. However, the claim tied to Chapter 88 is tied to the speech. And so unlike a traditional Chapter 88 claim, and Chapter 88 really is tied to three different types of entities. And so they're defined both as a health insurance carrier, which our client is not, a health maintenance organization, which again is tied to insurance, and then a managed care entity. A managed care entity, what you'd have to do to plead that claim is what the standard of care is for a managed care entity and how my client deviated from that standard of care. And then under the Commission for Lawyers Discipline versus Rosales, which this panel decided just in April, you look at those facts and you determine...
Part of this panel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Part of this panel.
Yes, Your Honor.
There was a concurrence in that opinion, if you remember.
Yes, Your Honor, falling through the looking glass. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, Your Honor, it's important to recognize how it's pled, because under Chapter 88, if there was a claim pled under Chapter 88, you'd have the specific facts, the standard of care alleged, how that was deviated, and what the damages are tied to that. They don't do that here. Looking back at the claims that they actually plead and the words they use tied to the speech, it takes it out of a traditional 88 claim or 74 claim and is tied principally upon her reliance upon Dr. Glom's comments during the fair hearing. And again, that's important because all of this starts to arise, not just out of the denied claim, but out of the fair hearing before a state hearing officer, again, public forum, petition to government.
Doesn't a lot of this go to the weakness or validity of their claim as a healthcare liability claim, but not to the TCPA applicability?
I think principally it starts with the TCPA, given the way they've phrased their claims. They're the master of their petition. They're the master of their pleadings. They've pled it as a speech claim. Now, of course, understandably now, they're trying to crawfish away from that and suggest that, no, this is truly a bodily injury claim. But, Your Honor, if this court were to apply the TCPA, this court would not be denying the appellees with a remedy. There would still be a remedy if they came back and were to actually plead a Chapter 88 claim or a Chapter 74 claim against providers. There are other defendants in this matter. But they pled the claims in the manner they pled them, tying it to speech, and so this is not your typical 88 claim because it's all tied to the speech.
But I mean, wouldn't you agree that there is bodily injury in this case?
I would agree that there is bodily injury,
but
yes.
You're saying it's not connected to the claim that they brought.
It is not connected to the claim they've pled. And so we're not contending that there wasn't some grievous injury to a minor, Your Honor. There is a grievous injury to a minor. I have a child of my own. And so when I hear about facts that there's an injury to a child, of course that resonates with me. But here, based upon the way they pled their claim, it's still prevented from proceeding under the TCPA. In this court, even if this court were to look at the negligence claim or the negligence per se claim, which neither of which they meet their burden under Rosales with respect to having clear and specific evidence, the court under Cavan v. Abbott can parse the claims and say, okay, this intentional infliction of emotional distress claim is precluded by the TCPA.
Wasn't that claim already dropped? You say that in your briefing that the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim was already dropped?
That's correct, Your
so
Honor.
So why are you arguing about it now?
I'm arguing it because you look at the operative pleading at the time the TCPA claim is filed. Yes, it was amended out. Both of us briefed it. I do think that given the fact the claim is amended out, it's largely moot, but under the TCPA, you look at the claims as pled at the time the motion was filed to avoid a creative plaintiff from amending around the TCPA to avoid its application. And so looking at Cavan v. Abbott, which is this Court of Appeals in 2017, the court looked at, and I see I'm running short on time, the court looked at an assault claim married with a host of other claims. The court then went through the analysis of the TCPA, finding, number one, that the TCPA applied, and then number two, going through the appellee's burden with respect to clear and specific evidence, and found that all claims but assault were barred and were properly dismissed under the TCPA. So even if this court were to find that some bodily injury claim were to survive, which we don't think it should, given the way they've pled it, is tied to speech, again, 47 to 68 references to speech, the petition to government. Even if the court were to find that it applies, number one, the court wouldn't be denying a remedy because there are still providers out there. There's still other defendants. There are still other mechanisms through perhaps better pleading that's not focused upon speech. There could be a potential remedy. I see that I'm running short on time. I will reserve the remainder of my argument for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hancock. Morning, Mr. Lowe.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm here proud to represent Linda Badawo and Deshaun Badawo. It might be helpful to, again, just understand what this case is about or think about what it is exactly that's at issue in terms of the suit. We've alleged that Superior Health Plan, who was charged with administering health care benefits in terms of insurance to my client, failed to do so, failed to abide by the doctor's recommendations for 24-hour nursing care, and as a result, when they denied the claim, my client pulled out his trach and suffered bodily injury because he didn't have a nurse present like he should have.
Would you have your same claims if they had never opened their mouths and said a word to convey that they were denying the claim?
Of course. That's
so without any communication whatsoever?
The communications show the admissions of guilt or the plotting. We may have the only claim that may turn more on whether or not they opened their mouth is a fraud claim because they defrauded Ms. Badawo by telling her that they would take care of it in front of the HHSC on a fair hearing call and then turned around and did not do that. She relied on that. But the claim in essence is that they caused bodily injury to our client, which they're responsible for under Chapter 88, and if not common law negligence or other duties under the law. And as a result, he's been harmed. That's not a free speech claim. It's not their free speech that would be at issue at that point. This case is not about a 3-year-old foster kid chilling their ability to deny claims and somehow that infringes their constitutional rights to do so. This is where the TCPA has reached its most absurd point. And I know I've read many, many cases where courts of appeals have grappled with the issue that the TCPA has been stretched so far that now we're at the position that a billion-dollar insurance company can claim that a foster kid is denying their own free speech claims when that seems absurd. So I think 3 points in my argument would make the point or the case on why this court should affirm the denial as it may on any independent ground that would defer, which could be used by the trial court to have denied the motion. First, that the TCPA does not apply to their claims of free speech. Second, that the exemptions are so clear that there's no need to look any further, especially the exemption on bodily injury, but also the other two as it relates to arising out of an insurance contract or commercial speech. And third, because there is actual evidence that we put in the record about the bodily injury that was caused and the other claims that there is clear and specific evidence, which the Texas Supreme Court has said can be the pleadings themselves, although we added much more than that. First, on whether or not the TCPA applies, I think it may be interesting to this court to know that your sister courts of appeals have come out with decisions almost on a daily basis on the TCPA in the last few months, trying to rein it in, and some of them are applicable. For example, and I apologize, we were not able to brief it because it obviously these opinions occurred after the briefing was closed. But for example, Staff Care Inc. versus Eskridge Enterprises, which came out of Dallas on May 15th, so we're talking about a few days ago, this could be found at 2019 Westlaw 212-1116. That found that statements made by a staffing agency about doctors to doctors were not a matter of public concern, even though it was in the context of health and safety and health care and things like that. The court went to explain that the what matter of public concern is may turn basically on whether or not someone has a financial incentive, which is what Superior's dealing with, whether or not they're going to pay a claim. That's not public concern. That's a business concern. That's their independent business concern. At most, it's my client's health and safety. It's not this public concern of health and safety that's at issue. In that case, it was the business concern of the staffing agency that the Dallas court said that's not public concern. That's too far. It's too individualized. That also, same case, found that even if it could be a public concern, which it found it wasn't, the commercial speech exception applies because they're talking about their own services in an individualized situation with their clients and also with doctors. Now, they made the same argument they made here, which is, oh, well, the audience wasn't, you know, our, their clients. Well, that's not true. In this case, Superior's audience is HHSC, its contractual client, who pays it $1.9 billion a year. It also is my clients who are its insureds. And so that case is almost directly on point. And yet, you know, that's just one of many that have come out in the last few days. Another interesting one.
Is there some aspect of the contract that entails that they communicate with your client? Those communications fall under the contract as well?
It falls under the contract, yes, Your Honor, because, you know, part of their responsibility as a managed care organization is to administer benefits, to have a policy. My client has a membership card. He has a policy that he can abide by in terms of, you know, appealing claims, which happen here, seeking coverage. Those are types of statements. Those are issues that are natural, normal business conversations that occur between a managed care organization and its insured and with the HHSC who oversees that insurance and Texas Medicaid. So these are not free speech concerns. These are not petitioning concerns that are at issue here. This is just the denial of benefits that should have been paid. Now, in terms of the exceptions, I think they're even clearer, and that's why, you know, as much as we could wrap our head around why would the legislature want the, you know, free speech rights of this entity or supposed or characterize these as free speech rights to apply in this situation, the exemptions are crystal clear to show that they didn't. The first exemption, recovery for bodily injury. Now, I think it's interesting that all three exemptions at issue start with the same precise language. It says, this chapter does not apply to illegal action. That phrase precedes each of the three exemptions we're talking about. Legal action is defined in the statute as a lawsuit or a claim. In this case, a lawsuit. So in other words, this legislature has said, this chapter does not apply to illegal action seeking recovery for bodily injury. This is a lawsuit seeking recovery for bodily injury. It doesn't matter what the theory is. In fact, the cases they cite, like the Anderson case, was saying the same thing. It can be assault. It can be medical negligence. It can be, in this case, Chapter 88. It could be common law negligence. It can be breach of certain other duties. But it's seeking recovery for bodily injury. It can't be any clearer. There's no allegation here that we're not seeking recovery for bodily injury. There's no evidence suggesting that. Now, they may want you to jump to the merits of the claim, but the Texas Supreme Court was pretty clear. It's a two-step process. First, you look at whether the statute applies. Then you determine whether or not there's a prima facie case. You don't have to reach the prima facie case even, because you can tell that clearly we've pled, and pleading's enough or alone evidence under the statute that bodily injury is being sought for in terms of recovery. Also, is this arises out of an insurance contract. Now, I was baffled below after briefing that argument in the district court that they weren't an insurance company, which I thought was a little bit too much, because I know, in fact, they are. They refer to themselves as an insurance company even in their own documents, and certainly in the managed care contract. But essentially, this arises out of the insurance benefits that my client was denied. That exemption is crystal clear, that a legal action, in other words, a lawsuit arising out of an insurance contract, is exempt from the statute. I don't know how that couldn't apply here. It couldn't be clearer. Also, the exemption on commercial speech. Now, that's only more complicated because there's been so much case law on what is and what's not commercial speech exemption. But in this case, the statements that they made to HHSC were made to their customer, HHSC, but also to their customer, Ms. Badawo, and you know, in the context of administering insurance benefits, that's commercial speech. That's clearly with the exemption. Their argument was the intended audience was not the actual purchaser of the services, and I think that's absolutely wrong. The intended audience of the purchaser is HHSC, but it also was Ms. Badawo who receives those benefits. Now, they try and weave between one exemption, then out of the other exemption. Essentially, they can't have it both ways. Either it's recovery for bodily injury, or it's from an insurance contract, or if it's not insurance services, it's talking about the insurance services, but any of those exemptions would apply. And so to suggest they don't, I think, suggests too much. In other words, nothing would fall under these exemptions. And the pleadings, I think, make them crystal clear.
Can I ask you a question? In the briefing, something about standing and questioning whether or not you actually had standing to bring this case. Can you discuss a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And standing was another one of those issues that was brought up in the reply brief. It was in a footnote in the appellant's brief. My client has standing because she's the adoptive mother. The long case law is that parents have standing to bring claims on behalf of minors because they can't bring them on behalf of themselves. And so we brought that, but we also named her as next friend because some of the events that occurred in this case, in other words, some of the harm occurred while he was still a foster child. And so there is also Chapter 44, which allows one who is a legal guardian to bring a claim as next friend. We brought it both ways, and probably unnecessarily, right? The whole point of the next friend chapter rule is to allow people to bring claims when they don't have parents anymore. The case they cited, the Bridgestone case, I believe, was one in which the parents were killed in an accident. So the kids needed to bring their claims, and the grandparents brought them as next friend. And the reason why it was issued in that case is the court was trying to determine whether or not the next friend was a plaintiff for purposes of form non-convenes or not. You know, that's not at issue in this case. The whole point is my client has standing because she's the mother. Now, if there was a standing issue, they should have raised it below, which I would say they waived it. But if there's a standing issue, I think I don't see it.
Can I ask, is standing even before us on a TCPA motion to dismiss appeal?
I'm sorry?
Is standing even before us at this point?
I can't imagine how it could be, other than they put it in their reply brief, but I would think that would be way too late. So I appreciate that we would address it because we were not able to address it sufficiently in our briefing. We did have a footnote as well in our appellee brief citing the case law saying that adoptive parents have standing. They also made a few other arguments in their reply brief, which I thought were new, that I could not anticipate. One of them was this, I think, absurd proposition that one must cite to all record sites in the argument section of a brief instead of just in the statement of facts. And fortunately, the Texas Supreme Court in 2004 rather, found that that is not, in fact, an issue. City of Arlington versus State Farm, 145 Southwest 3rd, 165. If you cite to the record in the statement of facts, you don't have to recite to the record in the argument. I just thought that was an interesting argument they made about us not showing a prima facie case. It's not a situation where we've just dumped a bunch of evidence in the record and pointed to it and said there must be a fact issue in there somewhere. We obviously pointed to the facts, and the facts were that this child had coverage. He was an enrollee of Superior. He applied for benefits. His doctor asked for 24-hour nursing care. That nursing care was not only not covered, but it was cut down to 12 hours a day, and he had to share with his sister. And then whenever the nurse was not present, he pulled out his trach and suffered bodily injury in a very devastating way. So I think that is all clearly pointed out in the record, not only below it and also in this court. Mr. Hancock made a reference to whether or not an expert would be required. We actually did serve an expert report within the time period permitted under Chapter 88. That all occurs after a TCPA motion because you have 120 days to serve an expert report, whereas a TCPA motion is done the first 30 or 60. So those types of things that they want to bring in terms of the merits of the claims, you don't really reach anyway because the exemptions and the statute do not apply. But even if you got there, we put forward a prima facie case, which is that this child suffered injury because his nurse wasn't present. Nurse should have been present. That's what the doctors said. And they didn't cover it. And they should have because they're responsible for it. And, you know, the other issue that I think is applicable in terms of to the purpose of the statute, and I think sometimes the courts of appeals who are able to grapple with it appropriately look back at the purpose stated in the statute. The purpose is to protect the constitutional rights of citizens of the state of Texas to speak or petition the government or associate, and to protect meritorious lawsuits and the bringing of those. Neither one of those are being protected if, for some reason, Superior Health Plan were able to throw out this lawsuit because they think their rights to deny claims for coverage are infringed, somehow infringing what is called free speech in the statute. That drags the statute too far. It's just not, that's not appropriate. That's not what the legislature intended. It's not when they reference public concern that they intended. It's not when they reference health and safety that they intended. I think they intended that if Superior wants to go out and issue it, talk to reporters about how they're such a great company or how they're the best health and safety company in the world, or someone says the opposite about that and criticizes them, that's public concern speech, no doubt. Saying that this child should not have been covered and telling him that, and telling his mother that, and telling HHSC that, that's not public concern. That's not health and safety. That's just a jack. That's nothing. I did want to cover Kirk Stahl just a bit because I think it's important to note that in that case, it wasn't the person pulling the trigger who's the defendant, right? It's a TV producer. You don't have to cause the bodily injury with your own hands for the exemption to apply. You just have to have a cause of action asserted against you that seeks the recovery of bodily injury, no matter what the theory. And so I think Kirk Stahl is directly on point. I don't know how they could say that it's not. I also think that the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, whether or not it's at issue, was perfectly pled and perfectly wrapped up in the exemption. If you recall, also the exemption on bodily injury is actually quite broad when you read it. It has two clauses. First, it says seeking recovery for bodily injury, and then it says goes on to say, or to statements made regarding that legal action, right? And so statements regarding, in this case, claims against Superior, their legal dispute, in this case, what Superior said back in terms of trying to make my client concerned or hurt her, those are all statements regarding the cause of action that seeks recovery for bodily injury. So even the one claim which may not seek recovery for bodily injury, the intentional infliction of emotional distress, still falls within the exemption.
Does Texas law still require some sort of harm or physical injury to accompany that for it to be a valid claim?
A manifestation of some type of injury, right? So it's like crying or exhibiting emotional distress and things like that. There's a lot of law on what one would have to suffer, how much they would have to suffer. I think that we've pled plenty enough in that, even if we wanted to bring the claim again, and in terms of explaining what she went through whenever they suggested they, you know. Also, it would fall under the commercial speech exemption as well, because the statements that they are making, again, are made about their product and whether or not their services were appropriate to the recipient of those services, or at least to the, you know, representative of the recipient of those services, Ms. Badawo, as well as about her. So, I mean, all of these fall within the exemptions. One of the things that I think that the appellants miss in their brief, and I just don't understand why they see it this way, is they say, well, Adams says, the Texas Supreme Court says, anything can be communication. Well, yeah, I mean, that part of the TCPA, but it still has to be about public health and safety or something of that nature to be what falls within the speech. But they say that in Adams, because the way the statute is written is quite broad on certain things, like what is a legal action, right? What's equally broad on what is an exemption. The exemptions use the same exact language as the statute does in terms of applicability. Just the way, same way the statute says any communication about relating to a legal action or relying on or whatever, the exemptions also say any legal action, in this case seeking recovery for bodily injury or arising out of an insurance contract or about commercial speech to the intended audience. And so if they're right that somehow this is applicable here, under the normal terms of the TCPA without looking at the exemptions, then they would have to be right that the exemptions would also apply. So in other words, there's no way they can get to the TCPA applying without running full-fledged into the exemptions.
Is there any authority for that proposition, that we're supposed to interpret these exemptions broadly I'm thinking, you know, if you look at the Open Records Act or the tax code, generally the exemptions are construed narrowly. Do we have any authority here telling us otherwise?
Well, I think there are two things. First, the statute itself says the act should be construed liberally and for its purposes, and I think the exemptions are evoking the purposes of the legislature to protect meritorious lawsuits in certain situations, in this case, bodily injury insurance and commercial speech. Second of all, I think that the court in Adams, when it discusses what is necessary to determine whether or not the act applies, you only have to look at the pleadings. You don't have to. Evidence in this case, defined by the statute, can be just pleadings, as long as it's stating the facts on which you're relying on to invoke, in this case, the exemptions or invoke the statute. And in this case, I think that's how you interpret it on its face. I think the review this court does of that is de novo, right? You're looking at the statute, you know, the plain text of this statute, 21 or 27.010, you're reading it, what is bodily injury? What does this apply to bodily injury? Is this a recovery? That's all de novo legal review. I don't think that there's anything that you need to do to interpret them more or less narrowly. All I'm saying is that the words used that have been interpreted and for purposes of bringing the TCPA claim apply equally for purposes of the exemptions. Finally, I'd like to point out this. Superior has taken action to basically cause my client harm. He can't speak anymore. And the fact that they claim their free speech is lost is, you know, quite wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Lowe. You.
A lot of points to hit with very little time with which to hit them. A number of things, I think, arise in the context of the responsive argument. Number one, counsel suggests on behalf of appellee, when focusing upon the speech, the center of their claims, they talk about, number one, the plotting. Again, that's the petition to the state government. And then number two, they say that Ms. Badawo relied upon the speech. And I want the court to remember that in particular in two contexts. Number one, the reliance element is part of the fraud claim, where she contends that Superior defrauded her by saying, we're going to work on this, we're going to come up with a solution. But then she also states in the petition that she did not rely upon it and, in fact, rejected that solution. Therefore, the fraud claim itself cannot be actionable, nor do they meet the clear and specific evidence burden to establish the fraud claim. It's also impactful on the issue of standing. Standing, like jurisdiction, can never be waived. It cannot be. Standing is raised both in the appellant's opening brief and then also the reply brief. It's not reserved just for the reply. Standing is important because counsel suggested that Ms. Badawo brought her claim in two capacities. The pleadings alone indicate that it's only brought as next friend, not as a parent. Also, the pleadings indicate that she was not the parent at the time of the injury. She clearly says that he was still a foster child, not a parent. Counsel suggests that she has standing to come in as the parent of the child. She didn't adopt until after the injury. It's also important because with respect to the commercial speech exemption, counsel suggests that she is the buyer of the goods. The buyer of the goods, to the extent there are goods at all, would be HHSC. And on relying upon the Castleman versus Internet Money case, the speech itself, the exception applies to the commercial speech that does no more than propose a commercial transaction. Who is the commercial transaction that is being proposed to in this matter? He contends that it's Ms. Badawo.
It's your proposition that HHSC is the only one who could have brought these claims.
I think that no, but as pled, the way they've pled it, Ms. Badawo cannot bring it, neither as next friend nor as the mother of the child. Here, if HHSC were to have a claim against Superior, they have a breach of contract claim that is not tied to the speech, but is based upon the structure, not of an insurance contract, as they broad brush describe it, but as a contract between the state and Superior. And in fact, counsel suggested and offered evidence, some of the only evidence that was not stricken from the record, some of the audits and some of the investigation by HHSC related to some of these allegations. And so there is a remedy to HHSC with respect to any alleged breach of the contract between Superior and HHSC. But it's instructive with respect to applying the exemption on commercial speech, because counsel said that Ms. Badabo was the intended recipient of the speech. She was not. There's no evidence to suggest that she was a member, that she was receiving the services, either as a mother or otherwise, because she wasn't the mother. The speech was directed to the fair hearing officer. The speech was directed in terms of the denying the claim to her as a foster parent. But that was not for purposes of consummating commercial transaction.
At the end of the day, was it HHSC that denied the claim?
At the end of the day, Superior stands in the shoes of HHSC under the contract in adhering to the standards set by the state to deny claims, because there's an overriding desire to avoid fraud, waste, and abuse. And so HHSC charges my client to make sure there's no abuse, no unnecessary hours with nurses, no unnecessary surgeries. And so ultimately, yes, in the standing in the shoes of HHSC, but that is delegated to Superior to make those determinations. Briefly, I'll hit on a few more points. Counsel suggested that it was not his burden to point the court to clear and specific evidence with respect to each prima facie element of his claims, and suggest through the brief, and I ask the court to look at the appellee's brief, there are no citations to the record with respect to the prima facie burden. In fact, what they say is, we've done enough. The court is very clear in Serafine versus Blunt, this court, 2015, that conclusory statements are not probative evidence and will not suffice to meet the prima facie burden of the non-movement on the TCPA claim. Texas Supreme Court in Henry Lipsky said you must provide clear and specific evidence, not mere notice pleading, for each element. This court, again in Commission for Lawyer Discipline, went through and said specifically, clear means unambiguous. Look at the petition, it's not unambiguous. Specific means explicit. You look at the briefing both before the trial court and the briefing before this court, there's no explicit reference, there's not even an appellate citation. PFC, again, is sufficient evidence to establish the claim, if not controverted. They don't even attempt to meet that burden. With respect to Your Honor's question, I see I've only got a short time. The Texas legislature was very specific with respect to the exceptions. If they wanted to accept Chapter 88 or 74, they could have. The broad interpretation applies to the application of the TCPA. The narrow language with respect to the cases we cited have a very narrow approach with respect to the application and the analysis of the exemptions. We'd ask the court to review our briefing. For these reasons, we ask the court to reverse and render. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hancock. Thank you, Mr. Lowe, for a fine argument. Interesting case. The case will be submitted. Court will stand at recess. You all excuse. Thank you.